Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
And my guest in the studio this week, excellent guest who has written a book, which I think in and of itself is pretty special. And she's been on the programme before, and we're going to talk about a book I think she was mentioning that she was writing last time she was on the programme. It's now here. I've got a copy of it in the studio. It's called Say Why to Drugs, and Dr. Susie Gage is behind it. Dr. Susie joins in the studio. Great to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It must be epic writing a book. Just that thing of just getting it all down there.
Yes, yes.
And then handing it in.
I've had a bit of practice because I wrote my PhD thesis as well, but they're sort of similar but different, I guess, in terms of the writing process. It was strange writing this book while also doing a full-time job. So lots of evenings and weekends of reading and writing and, yeah.
It's really comprehensive in terms of what it does and the way that it does it. We'll come on to sort of how it stacks up as well. First and foremost, just remind us about sort of yourself and how you come at the world of drugs.
So I'm a senior lecturer at University of Liverpool. I've been up here working at the uni for the last 3 years now. And I do research interested in trying to understand the links between recreational drug use and mental health. Because we know that we see drug use at higher levels in people with poor mental health. But why that is quite hard to unpick. It might be that using drugs, and when I say drugs, I do mean things like alcohol and tobacco as well. I don't see them as being separate just because they're legal. They're still drugs. So we see drug use, including alcohol and tobacco, at higher rates in people with poor mental health. But that could be because the drugs cause that. But it also could be that people with poor mental health seek out something to sort of make their life easier or take their mind off how they're feeling or sort of self-medicate symptoms. It could also be that something that happens earlier on in life or something genetic, even something environmental, might actually influence both your likelihood to develop poor mental health and your likelihood to try and continue to use substances. So that what I want to do in my research is try and unpick that, but it's really difficult.
Well, I imagine that, you know, the way you piece it together is evidence-based, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're looking at this is the thing, this is what we know, these are the scientific studies, and these are, you know, a measure or a balance on whether or not these can offer us an insight. But I almost got a sense as well, there was almost like a philosophical thing going on in regard to, because so many of these substances and things have been around for many hundreds of years and have become, you know, illegal, then they've been legal, and then, you know, well, it was good enough for Queen Victoria, but now it's not good enough for everybody else. And it's, so there's like a philosophical thing going on all the while, that you can talk about alcohol and you can talk about nicotine and tobacco, but then you can also talk about MDMA and you can talk about CAT, K-H-A-T, and various different things. And each one you look at from a different point of view, based around stigma, preconceptions, the legality, the illegality,
yeah,
versus the science of the whole thing as well. So I kind of got this sense that you must have been trying to balance all of these things up throughout.
Well, part of the difficulty was that as I started to research each substance, I just found it was so interesting that there was loads of stuff that I wanted to add in. So trying to kind of weave a sort of narrative together that was interesting and informative and useful. So I was kind of picking and choosing which bits. And also I do like to sneak in sort of stealth statistics lessons and evidence interpretation lessons, I guess. Because one of the things, when I first started researching drugs, one of the first things I noticed is when I was doing my PhD in the sort of early 2000s, was just that there's so much kind of misinformation out there, sensationalist headlines, you know, all of this kind of thing. And actually, it's really hard to kind of navigate your way through that and work out, well, what's good quality evidence? What's hyperbole? And how do I navigate my own choices and my own decision making in life, of like, if I do want to use a substance or if I do want to drink alcohol even, how do I weigh up the risks in a kind of informed, evidence-based way? And it was really hard.
In each of the sections, you've done the myths and the misconceptions, which is really interesting, because as part of that, people will read things that they quote know, yeah, about drugs. So for instance, cocaine will rot your septum, which is based, I think, on one photo
of
Daniela Westbrook. Yeah. Cocaine sobers you up. If you use cocaine once, you can and will become addicted. Are these things that you were kind of aware of, or were these things that you found cropped up when you looked at what people were saying about drugs, like cocaine?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. To be honest, I found social media incredibly useful for kind of collecting these myths and misconceptions. I did sort of shout outs of, what's the weirdest thing you've ever heard about cocaine, or what kind of things do you believe about LSD, but you've never seen any kind of evidence for it, or that kind of thing. So some of them I came to from that way. Others of them are kind of, yeah, urban legends and things that you sort of hear, or even things that make newspaper headlines sometimes.
Well, there's a great example of it when you talk about, I'm going to say this word wrong, cannabinoids.
Cannabinoids, yeah.
Cannabinoids.
I mean,
spice.
Yeah.
Which is probably the big newspaper grabber at the moment, the zombie drug.
Yeah.
You know, the zombie fire, and people will go, well, it's true, because I've seen people on the streets and they were acting like zombies, but you've looked at what's going on here and you've declared that to be a myth.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think I've seen people so intoxicated on alcohol that they can't stand up or speak properly, but you never ever hear of people calling them zombies. And so it's the stigmatizing term of saying, oh yeah, spice turns people into zombies. And we've seen it throughout the ages with various different drugs, and it's usually aimed at particular populations of people. So we saw it with PCP in the US, which was a drug that was being predominantly used by black people, and then it got called zombie. And here we've got spice, which is being predominantly used by homeless people, and they get called zombies. And it's this kind of othering and stigmatizing language that actually extreme intoxication effects are bad, and we should help people not to get into that state, but sort of condemning them for that and using sort of dehumanizing language, like referring to someone as the undead. You can't get much more dehumanizing than that. I think that's the thing that I'm kind of calling out by calling that a myth.
For each chapter, you could probably also go back through various media outlets over many, many decades and pick out the moral panic that came through. So you can have ecstasy, MDMA, and the rave scene. You can have cannabis culture at any point, probably over the last 40 or 50 years, even further back than that one. Spice, probably at the moment. But reading, just looking at alcohol, first and foremost, which you kind of class in with all these other things because it's a substance. The evidence around alcohol is pretty damning, isn't it? For all the terrible things, isn't it awful about ecstasy deaths? Of course it is. Isn't it terrible about all these other things that are going on? When you look through the alcohol stuff, there's like a really strong argument that says, why are we selling this stuff? Why are we drinking this stuff? Why are we going anywhere near this stuff? It's strange, isn't it? But we've placed that on the right side of the line.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, that's another one of my kind of bugbears, which sort of, I think, probably comes out through the book, is that we have, particularly here in the UK, but also in lots of other places, this sort of hypocrisy where we talk about drugs and alcohol as if alcohol is somehow in its own unique category. But what we know about alcohol in terms of what it does in the brain is that it's a particularly sort of potent substance in that it has an effect on almost all of the neurotransmitters that we have in our brain, whereas lots of drugs will work on sort of or alter the effect of one or two of them, but alcohol has an effect on all sorts of them. It's why alcohol intoxication can be quite different on different occasions. It's what's called biphasic, so it can start off seeming like it can sort of wake you up when you first start drinking, make you more chatty and sociable, and then suddenly you hit this sort of depressant side and you slump and you slur your words and you physically slump or potentially pass out even. And yeah, it's really bad for our livers, we know that, and it's not particularly great for our mental health, it seems, as well.
I was reading up on alcohol and alcohol dependency as part of something I was doing a couple of years ago. And there was an article I read, it was talking about the normalization of alcohol through the mainstream media. And from that point of somebody saying the normalization of alcohol in the mainstream media, I can't not see alcohol in absolutely everything. Yeah. There was a Saturday morning TV show, James Martin's Saturday Kitchen, whatever he does on ITV now. And he was cooking something at 9:30 in the morning. And he went, there you go, there's a thing. And then he pours a glass of wine with it. It's like 9:45 by this point. There was a thing last night I watched with Julia Bradbury travelling around the Greek islands, Santorini, lovely. But she's trying out this food from Santorini. Looked wonderful. But of course, she had a glass of wine with it. And she went, glass of wine at 11 a.m., winning at life. Yeah. And I thought, oh, it's really, really normal now.
Insidious,
and then, of course,
yeah.
You know, we drink when we celebrate. We drink when we commiserate. We drink when we're having a great time. We drink when we're having a terrible time.
Yeah.
And that's like a socially dependent thing. It's like the crook that we as a society lean to when we're going through anything. You've got to have a drink.
Yeah. And it can make it incredibly difficult. If you have had a problem with alcohol and you've decided to stop drinking, then it can really make you feel sort of ostracized from support of friends if every social occasion is underpinned with alcohol. But that's why I'm so sort of heartened to see this boom in kind of alcohol-free alternatives, things like low and no alcohol beers, or even things like kombucha as well. So you can sort of go out socializing, but you don't have to drink so much. There are other kind of options available. I think that is really promising.
Although I did notice that low alcohol stuff, it still says like it's 0.05, but you talk about that in the caffeine section as well, don't you, when you talk about decaffeinated things.
Yeah.
When people go, oh no, I'm going decaffeinated now, and that's a little bit of a myth in and of itself, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's definitely like if you want to cut down, that's no bad thing. And with things like the very, very low ABV beers and things, you physically couldn't drink enough to get intoxicated because your body metabolizes that amount of alcohol more quickly than it, you can absorb it. But if you're trying to give up caffeine completely, then there is still some caffeine in things like decaffeinated teas and coffees, but also in things like chocolate as well. So it's very, very hard to completely remove psychoactive substances in their entirety from your life. But it's getting easier to vastly reduce them.
In terms of how you talk about each of the different substances, it really strikes me that each one has its own kind of journey through both your body, but also then its impact as well. It's not just I took this, so I felt like this. They're wide ranging, including often the come down as well. Mm-hmm. At the other side, as I guess when we've got to make decisions around substances, we've got to be aware of the full journey, if you like, as to whether or not it's beneficial.
Yeah,
I know plenty of people of my age now who've started to get really, really bad hangovers to the point where they don't drink hardly anything anymore.
Yeah.
Or choose to drink slightly better quality stuff, but less of it, because they've gone through that journey so many times.
Decided,
they just think it's
no
not
more,
even
yeah.
worth it.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find so fascinating about all of this is not only is that the case that different substances have different kind of intoxication and after effects and that kind of thing, but also the mood that you're in, how much you've eaten that day, where you are, who you're with, all of that will impact on the type of intoxication you have as well. And that's something that's sort of harder to get your head around, maybe, that it's not just the substance itself, but it's what we bring to it too. And I think it's particularly the case with psychedelics, where the intoxication effect is so kind of personal and in your head. But it's true for other substances as well, that alcohol will have a different effect if you're at home versus if you're out in a group or in a pub, or, you know. And if you go to a kind of drinking occasion when you are in a bad mood, perhaps it might help to begin with, but by the end of the night, actually, it could have made you feel a whole lot worse, and then probably even worse again the next day when you're hungover.
Which I guess is why sort of the scientific study in sort of laboratory sort of conditions can make a difference if you can recreate something which allows you to measure all of those aspects as well. Have you been surprised by almost the lack of evidence? There's not more evidence around this stuff, that alcohol is so pervasive in society, that caffeine is absolutely everywhere, that cannabis has been around for all this time. There's countless other drugs which people will be well and truly aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of get the sense that these studies almost seem a little bit standalone, that it's found certain things, but has it actually informed government policy potentially? Has it changed our global attitudes to certain types of drugs?
It's a good question. I think in terms of government policy, I think it's sort of a little bit naive for a scientist to say, oh, I think it should be entirely based on the evidence, the scientific evidence, because of course there are other factors that go into these kind of decisions as well. It would be nice maybe if it was a little bit more based on the evidence, but that's another debate, I guess. In terms of more sort of globally and like how we understand these substances, I think the point that you're making about how hard it is to do this research is a really good one, because we do know lots about certain aspects of these kind of like how drugs affect us, but we tend to know the sort of biological effects, and the sort of psychological and sociological effects are harder to research because, as you say, you can't really do that in a lab environment. You need to kind of look in the real world at what people choose to do and what people choose not to do, and then have to take all of other differences between people into account and all of this kind of thing to try and get a better understanding of how drugs fit in more kind of societally. But interestingly, it is something that, like, drug use is something that's been seen across cultures and across history. So it's not something sort of specific to now. It's something that seems like humans like to take drugs and have done for an incredibly long time.
And when I finished the book, I kind of thought, and that comes back to that point about philosophy, that this stuff is kind of, it's always here. I just wonder why we've not got a better grip of it,
yeah.
If you like. There's still so many myths and preconceptions about all of these things. Even though they're there, you can go and find them if you want to do your tests. If we were minded to do that, we could hire a load of great people who could go out and do all these tests, and we could get all the measures we were looking for. And then we could do something about it if we chose to do so.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's because there is still this sort of stigma, it may be the word, but also kind of moralizing around, like, particularly illicit drugs, people who choose to use drugs, and in particular, like, the people who have problems because of their drug use. And I guess that's kind of the key research population is, yeah, it's really interesting to know, like, why we're fascinated with drugs and everything. But from a sort of public health point of view, to me, the most important thing is people who really have problems from their drug use, how can we identify them, prevent them from going down that path in the first place, or support them if they have developed problems. And that's really tricky to do because there's obviously limited amounts of money, and there's still a perception that this is kind of a choice that people have made. People chose to use that drug the first time, and therefore it's their fault that they've developed this problem from doing so, when actually we wouldn't think that about any other kind of illness or anything like that. So I don't know, I find it quite depressing that we are in this situation where this is kind of, I mean, looking at as money is getting more and more scarce, things like support for people with dependence and addiction, that's those kind of services are what are being cut at the moment, and that's why maybe we're seeing the deaths from substance use going up at the moment. The most recent statistics were pretty appalling.
Let's talk about the chapter said entitled Focus on Drugs and Mental Health and the Strong Link Between Drug Use and Mental Health Problems. This is true of a lot of substances, writes Dr. Susie, including alcohol, cigarettes and cannabis. And it's true of a number of different mental health problems, including depression, anxiety and even more serious conditions such as psychosis and schizophrenia. Drug use causes poor mental health? The first interpretation is that taking a substance causes an increase in risk for poor mental health. There's some evidence that points in this direction. We know that psychoactive substances impact on some of the brain pathways and neurotransmitters that we think are also implicated in poor mental health, which could be an explanation. Also, substance use has often started before poor mental health symptoms are reported, which could suggest causality is going in that direction. So when people talk about chicken and egg,
yeah,
when it comes to drugs and mental health, which way round are we looking at that and should be looking at that?
Well, so that's kind of the point I'm trying to make in this. So there's little mini chapters throughout the book looking at concepts around, rather than just focusing on a specific substance, but thinking about concepts. And that's one of the ways to interpret seeing this link between drug use and mental health, is that the drugs are causing the mental health problems. And certainly some of the evidence does seem like that might be the case. But there are other ways to interpret the evidence as well. So it's really, really difficult to try and kind of unpick it. And it's also perfectly possible that it might go in both directions, that it could be that a substance might increase your risk, but then once you're having these mental health problems, that actually you start to turn to the substance for kind of a crutch or a support, or just to sort of give your mind a bit of a break to get into a different perceptual state, to have a bit of a break from the sort of depression or anxiety symptoms that you're feeling.
But there's also potentially, you say in the book, a third way.
Yeah.
Another factor, almost an environmental factor based on things that people have witnessed, lived experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. So particularly kind of traumatic experiences during childhood or kind of difficult living environment, difficult life experiences, all of these kind of things are linked to risk of poor mental health, unsurprisingly, but also likelihood that a person will use a substance. And if they do use a substance, that they might use it in a sort of heavier or potentially more harmful way. So it could be that actually the link that we see between drugs and mental health is just a sort of byproduct of one thing earlier in life, or lots of things earlier in life, causing both of those things. And actually the two might not be as related as we think.
But if we want to get a handle on that whole mix, if you like, is that something which can be measured, whereby you might have factors in place that might flag up at somebody, maybe at a young age, or might flag up in their early 20s, that a professional might be able to look at and go, okay, this link is coming from this direction, therefore this is a pathway for them, versus coming out from a childhood trauma point of view.
Yeah.
Is that something which you can framework, if you like, that then allows people to get help?
Well, this is one of the things that I'm really interested in my kind of research work as well, is like, okay, so in a way, it doesn't matter what direction these associations are going in. What matters is we need to identify who are the people most at risk so that they can be better supported. So the problem is that we actually still don't have a brilliant understanding of what causes mental health problems either, particularly like complex, serious mental health problems like psychosis or schizophrenia. I mean, there are people who would say that the term schizophrenia is wrong. It's meaningless, because there are so many different symptoms within that diagnosis of schizophrenia that actually two people could have no overlapping symptoms at all, but still be both diagnosed with the same illness. So some people are arguing that actually schizophrenia is kind of a useless term, and we need to start thinking more about clusters of symptoms than about labels. So given that we don't understand mental health very well and we don't understand drugs very well, trying to work out the links between the two and who's at risk is really, really difficult. But as you say, there are some risk factors that we have identified. It's just trying to work out, well, which ones of those are the sort of causally important ones? Which ones are the ones that drive the problems? And then are there any interventions or anything that we can do to sort of prevent these problems from occurring in the first place?
When we move on to addiction, something we've talked about a lot on Mental Health Monday, is that when the mix has changed? Is addiction the point where the substance is in charge and the body has adapted itself to rely on that substance? Is that a point of change whereby it's no longer a mix? It's your body is now programmed, if you like, to receive this substance.
Well, that's kind of the sort of dependence angle of it, but addiction is more about your relationship with the substance changing, because you can get addicted to anything, but important caveat, that doesn't mean that you're addicted to everything. Like the way we use the word addiction or addicted in kind of colloquial society, we can talk about anything from sort of ice cream to a TV show, you know, and basically we just mean I really like this thing. And really liking something is fine. But what I mean by your relationship with the substance or whatever it is changing is that it goes from a sort of a want to a need. And for it to be an addiction in terms of sort of thinking about a clinical or a research definition of addiction, there has to be some actual or potential risk of harm from your behaviour. But you would tend to say that someone had developed an addiction when their life had been knocked off kilter by the substance. So it might be impacting on their ability to work or their ability to maintain their relationships with their family or their friends, or they might find themselves becoming more isolated and their sort of relationship with that substance would change to feeling like it was something that they needed to be able to get by. When they were using that substance would be important. If you wake up and the first thing you think is, I can't face the day without having a drink or without having a smoke or, you know, whatever it is. So it's quite a complex idea, but it's more than just a sort of biological dependence on the substance. There's this kind of psychological aspect to it as well.
Can I ask you about the come down and coming out the back of taking a substance? And I think in the main, people associate that with a hangover first and foremost. There was a comedian, Adam Rowe, who did a bit of stand-up, and he was talking about if you take alcohol, it's like borrowing happiness from tomorrow, which I just thought was the best example that I could think of. That what it did was you'll feel good now, well, tomorrow. And actually, in scientific study, you found that levels within the brain dip below their normal levels.
Yeah.
It's almost as if your body's trying to give itself a kick to kind of go, oh, by the way, this is terrible. Before you get back up to norm, the come down can be really quite marked in countless of these substances that we talk about.
And it's particularly, well, there's a come down, and then there's also withdrawal, which is a slightly different but related thing. So, yeah, I think in a way it's unsurprising that if you alter the kind of chemical balance of your brain by taking a substance that in order for your brain to get back to normal, there's a kind of, if there's a, what goes up must come down, basically. And then withdrawal is something a little bit different, which is when you have built up a kind of tolerance to a particular substance and you need to have more of it to get the same effect, then that sort of depletion, it's not necessarily something going up or something going down. In some cases, it's the opposite, where using a substance will lower your levels of a particular neurotransmitter. But ultimately, the sort of behavioural or like the feelings are kind of the same, and that if you experience a particularly good time, then the kind of flip side of that is that you might feel a little bit worse the next day or however many days afterwards. And withdrawal is where, because your body has sort of become habituated to a particular substance, that actually what would have been your normal level doesn't feel normal anymore, because you feel like you need more of this kind of thing to feel at your kind of regular level. And that's when people start using a substance to get back to normal. The example that in the book about withdrawal that I think resonates with a lot of people is the one around caffeine. That actually probably quite a lot of us are habituated to caffeine, to the point that when we wake up and we feel groggy in the morning and we think, oh, I need my cup of coffee to give me that kickstart, actually what we're doing is bringing ourselves out of caffeine withdrawal rather than having a little extra boost from the caffeine. If we didn't have caffeine in the first place, we wouldn't feel as bad.
Because in the study, I think I'm right in saying, in the study, they found that those who had the coffee, yeah, great, they could achieve those levels, but only at the level of those who never took caffeine in the first place.
Yeah.
So they were always just great.
Non-caffeine users, yeah. Maybe they're those people who are really irritating for us.
So basically, if you have a cup of coffee, you go, oh, that's it, I can take on the day. If you didn't have and didn't drink any caffeine, you'd feel like that all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, though, you wouldn't notice the benefit, if you know what I mean. Like, you have to feel the bad thing to notice that you feel better afterwards.
This is why there's so much about psychology and philosophy
absolutely
around this book as well. It's available and it's out there now, Dr. Susie Gage, Say Why to Drugs, with a foreword by Scroobius Pip as well. There's a podcast that sits alongside this. Normally people do the book and then the podcast.
Just do everything backwards.
And it's available. Where can people get a copy of it, and where can they find out more information?
So the book is out now in all good bookshops. I'm doing a book launch at the end of February, I think the 27th of February, at the Waterstones in Liverpool One. Tickets are available for that now. It's available online. It's available in bookshops. The podcast you can download from all podcast receptacles
indeed.
Not the word I was aiming for, but never mind.
And we'll get a link up to the launch event on our social media as well. Dr. Susie, thank you for your time. Congratulations on the book.
And
I'm sure
thank
we'll speak
you
again very soon.